Well, the four scenarios are built on different ways that we might look at the world. They range from a sort of a utopian scenario through to a dystopian one. That means a really good future versus a really bad future and sort of everything in between. Mm. The good future is called Imagine, which is a world in which we sort of rely on our expertise and our savviness, and we solve all our problems. You're probably aware at the moment there's a big emphasis on design as a process for helping us deal with things like climate change and so on. And this future says, you know, we can wing it. We can do it. We're clever enough. The human race is clever enough that we can survive. So it's a future based on optimism. Technological optimism that we can get there. And then at its polar opposite, a scenario which we call Helter Skelter. And that's a world really gone upside down. I mean, it's everything's out of kilter. We've got pandemics. There are issues relating to climate change that we've been unable to solve. It's a world driven by fear. And, you know, if you think about the hotels on the Gold Coast, for example, and on the Sunshine Coast, you know, these would become refuges for rich people, you know, to sort of keep everybody else out.
Well, we sort of have that already, though, don't we, to a degree with gated communities?
Yes, that's right. But it's in this future, the tourism industry has collapsed. So, there's no point in owning a hotel. So the rich people sort of congregate there. That's a really extreme sort of view of the future, but it's one based on fear. Then in between, we have a future which I think is we call Please Please Me, which is a version of Gordon Gekko, Greed is Good, and it's sort of where we've been for the last 20 years or so. That's a future in which we continue to, you know, satisfy our wants and desires without caring too much about the future of the planet. So, you know, we have this sort of big irony at the moment that we need economic growth to drive wealth, to drive our ability to survive, but in doing that we're actually depleting our planet of its natural resources, and of course it's that future which might then spin off into the fear-based future if things go wrong.
But there's one more in between there too.
Yeah, there's one more which is we call Dear Prudence. You probably noted the titles are all based on Beatles sort of songs, but that's neither here nor there.
Yep.
It's just an imaginative way of framing it up. And the future relating to Dear Prudence is a bit like the Earth Hour. You know, the idea that once a year we turn everything off for an hour, but it's a bit like the Earth year. So we actually move to a framework where everybody's really concerned about the global future for the planet. And we work together collaboratively to try and preserve what we've got and to be economical, et cetera, et cetera. The problem with that future for me is it's a tad dull. We might survive, but I'm not sure I want to be in that particular future. But the purpose of all of this stuff, of course, is, I mean, it's not just crystal ball gazing. It's actually saying, you know, we need to be mindful of these alternatives, because if we don't develop policies, you know, at the government level, or local councils or whatever we're talking about, if we don't have policies that are sort of having a look at the way the world might turn out, we might find ourselves in a lot of trouble.
Now, they're the four scenarios, but how do you actually go about working out the various scenarios and what's involved in that?
Our basic process, we use a technique called scenario planning, which is well established and was sort of invented by the Shell company way back in the sort of 70s. And what we've done is to take the Shell approach to foresight, to looking at into the future. And we've then developed it and made it made it our own. We've customized, as it were, from the original sort of methodology. And the things that we are particularly interested in are the impact of the way we see the world on the way we actually define what the future might be like. And if I might pause there, John, and if we think about the issues relating to climate change, which have been in the news now for the last sort of 5 or 10 years, there's a strong issue. The issue is not really about the science. The issue is about the way we respond to the science. So the skeptics are the people who sort of, in terms of what I've been saying, in terms of the scenarios, who would be in the imagine camp and would think that we're clever and smart enough to work our way out of it. And the people on the other side, you know, the greenies and the environmentalists are in the Dear Prudence camp. They think, we might be smart, but we might not be smart enough in time. So that's one of the things we see, is the impact of the way we see the world on the way we frame policy. I mean, it's interesting if you think about Julia Gillard's announcements yesterday about Asia, that it's been such a long time coming. Mm. I mean, there was a book published, I think, 20 years ago almost, called Is Australia an Asian Country?, which was actually sort of dealing with the issues that are just beginning to percolate through at the level of government policy. So we like, you know, we're really interested in the way people see the world. The other thing, John, that we think is really important, which gets a bit, it's not emphasized enough, is that we all care about a better future. Mm. So that it's not enough just simply to say we have tools and techniques in scenario planning or whatever it is we're doing, that we have these tools and techniques for creating ideas about alternative futures. We actually want to then build into the process real need to transform the world we're in to make it a better world for everybody.
Yeah, we're talking about cost of transformation, I guess, the economy at the time and the political party who may be in power. So those, I guess, are the overriding factors. And I guess, you know, from what you said about Julia Gillard's comments about Asia yesterday, and, you know, it's the fact that we haven't done anything about changing sort of language syllabus in this country since, you know, looked at it since the 80s. Politics, I guess, in many respects, are holding us back.
Yes, and they're holding us back mainly because of the short-term nature. All political rewards are short-term. I mean, Julia Gillard's in government for 3 years, and, that means you spend only the first part of the process sort of trying to implement the policies that got you into power, and then you're worrying about looking at what the polls are doing and thinking about how you're going to get re-elected. And, you know, if you take transport, it's a very good example. The cost, I'm just thinking about Sydney. I live near in Sydney, near the M2. The cost of widening the M2, which is, I'm not sure how old the M2 is, but it's not more than 10 or 15 years old. The cost of widening the M2 far outweighs what it would have cost to add those dimensions, you know, those extra lanes at the beginning. And Blind Freddy can see what's happening. You look at the M25 in the UK, which went in 30 years, 40 years ago, and they've spent 20 years making it bigger. And we just don't learn from, you know, the past. And the thing I love about Sydney is there's one bit of transport sort of infrastructure that got it right, and that was the Harbour Bridge.
I was going to say that maybe you the Harbour Ferries as well.
And the ferries. Now, admittedly, we now have a tunnel, which has lengthened, as it were, the joy of the bridge. But, you know, when they built the bridge in 1930, whenever it was, you know, there are 8 lanes, not 4 lanes or 2 lanes. You know, they clearly understood that we had to build for a long-term future.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it, Oliver? Because I guess what you're saying is that, you know, futurists were possibly being listened to in that day and age, but they have sort of been forgotten in some respects.
Yeah, it's easy to be glib in this business, but one of my mantras is this, is that short-term policy that doesn't include the long-term is bad policy. So I don't mind the idea that we need to, you know, be thinking of a plan about what we do in terms of transport development in Australia over the next 3 years. That doesn't worry me at all as a focus. But if you're not actually using a long-term vision in creating that short-term proposal or set of policies, then you're going to get stuffed. There's no doubt about it.
There's one example comes to mind, Oliver, up here in our neck of the woods, the Sunshine Coast, the Woodford Folk Festival. They bought a very large piece of land a number of years ago because they know the festival will grow. And that was based on the fact of a church in England built hundreds of years ago where the priest or the minister at the time planted an oak tree right beside the church.
Yeah.
And then somebody said, why'd you plant that oak tree there? Because in 200 years' time, this roof's going to need replacing, and that timber will be there and ready to do just that.
I'm originally British, and my parents lived in the Isle of Wight. And if you're in Bembridge, which is a little coastal town, which has a sort of silted-up harbour, if you walk from Bembridge inland to a town nearby, you'll see a row of oak trees. And it's extraordinary. They're sort of just haphazardly, but across the fields. And what the ship's captains used to do when they came into Bembridge Harbour, as they walked home, because they couldn't all live in Bembridge, some had to live nearby, as they walked home, they dropped acorns. And it's really a lovely story because, and it's sort of, you know, your story reminds me of it. Mm. And the benefit of that, of course, and this is the point you're making, the benefit isn't immediate. But boy, are you glad about it later on.
Will you be giving copies of this book to Tony Abbott and Julia Gillard? Do you think they'll read them?
I think if there's a vote in it, they might. I'm sure they're very busy otherwise.
Winston Churchill, many years ago, one of his quotes I was reading recently was the fact, words to the effect that to look to the future, we have to look to our past. And I guess that's what you're saying in some respects.
I think there are two. Yeah, I certainly believe that we need to look to the past. But one of my little bugbears, and we're talking about sort of government policy, one of my bugbears is the notion that all policy has to be what is, you know, traditionally now called evidence-based. Now, the reality is that some of the best policy decisions that are made are not reality, are not based on evidence. They're actually based on somebody who sees themselves as a leader and thinks this is what we should do. And I think one of the things lacking in Australian politics, I'm a bit biased, I'm a bit sort of on the left, but, you know, probably since Keating, we've lacked a sense of a leader who's going to lead us, who's going to sort of try and paint for us a vision of the future that he or she will want us to join them in creating. I think we've lost that. I've just come back from London. I've just been on holiday, and there's a loony there running London, the Greater London Council, called Boris Johnson, who's absolute.
Well,
Boris is brilliant, and the reason he's brilliant is simply because
he's a bit loony.
He's leading. He does things because he thinks they're the sort of things we should be doing. And I think we have lost completely, in sort of bogged down with opinion polls and all that sort of stuff. We've lost the whole concept of a leader who's going to take us somewhere new.
Maybe the government should be employing, or the opposition for that matter, should be employing a science fiction writer.
Well, that would be a good thing. You know, funnily enough, in terms of scenario planning, you just reminded me, there in Singapore, the office of the Prime Minister, or the Premier, whatever he's called, has a scenario planning unit. It's actually a foresight unit actually in the Prime Minister's area. And I think that's brilliant. And they've been doing that for about 20 years. The problem with all these things, if you get too, I'm trying to think what the best way of describing it is. If you get too formal about the future, then in a way you can lose your way. We want ideas about the future to be integrated into what every department does. So when you read a green paper or a white paper or look at a new piece of legislation, it's actually got the future sort of integrated into it. The ideal sort of outcome for people who do what I do is that the work we should do should be just part of the normal daily round rather than something special and separate.
Should we have longer terms of people being in power in politics?
I think I definitely think at the federal level, the 3-year term is nuts. I would prefer a 5-year term, and a 4-year term would be better. You know, I understand that, you know, we don't want to get stuck for too long with a government we don't want, but there are processes for changing governments midterm.
If necessary, we've seen that happen before.
We certainly have.
So, Oliver, what do you think would be the most likely scenario? I look at the four and I think maybe a little bit of all.
Well, I think you're right, John. I mean, that's a very wise observation, because basically, I mean, they're conceits. I mean, we're not actually saying this future is going to come in sort of, you know, all neatly wrapped up like that. There are these four futures. They all have elements in them that have been extrapolated from what's happening now. But some of them include what we call wild cards and sort of, you know, the helter-skelter future is brilliantly elusive about it. Something clearly globally has gone wrong. And we've been very careful not to identify specifically what it is that goes wrong, but we leave the reader to sort of imagine that. So I think you're right. It will be bits of them all. And we're not in the probability business. I mean, I don't know any more than you do which of those futures is the most likely to come into play. What I do know is that all four are plausible, that there's a logic, they make sense. If you go into the book and look at all the background material, you'll see how we got to these futures.
It's fascinating stuff. Oliver, lovely to talk to you today. And let's hope that the future for our kids and grandkids is a nice one.
Thank you, John.